It's my pleasure to introduce the host of today's session, Faith Saley, who is an actress and comedian and radio and television personality. So join me in welcoming Faith. Thank you.
I was very glad to hear you all applaud, Debbie. I can't believe that this is only the second year of the book festival and that it's free. So let's give Debbie another round of applause. So welcome, everyone. This is such a wonderful turnout. Welcome to the Boston Book Festival's keynote, or as I like to call it, the Joyce Carol keynotes. Slow burn, right? It's really good to start with a bad joke, because then everything's going to be better from here on out. Okay. I am really, really very honored to introduce this, literary icon to you. When people speak of her, when reviewers write of her, the adjective prolific inevitably attaches itself to her name, but prolific also describes the Real Housewives franchise, Tea Partiers, Kate Gosselin, so it's not always a genius thing. Prolific doesn't do Joyce Carol Oates justice. I would say challenging, dangerous, revelatory, moving, unsettling, enduring. Here's what else she is. She's a recipient of the National Book Award and the Penn Malamud Award for Excellence in Short Fiction. Just some of her works are the national bestsellers We Were the Mulvaneys and Blonde, a finalist for the National Book Award and the Pulitzer Prize, and the New York Times bestsellers The Falls and The Gravedigger's Daughter. She's the Roger S. Berlin Distinguished Professor of the Humanities at Princeton University and has been a member of the American Academy of Arts and Letters since 1978. In 2006, she received the Chicago Tribune Lifetime Achievement Award. Is it very awkward to sit there while I'm reeling all of these off, or do you love it? She said it's sort of like being embalmed. Well, sit tight. There's a few more words to say, Joyce. The Booklist starred review for Oates' latest collection of short stories, Sourland, calls it a, quote, trenchant book of cruel fairy tales in which people are severely tested, profoundly punished, and tragically transformed. Her new collection of short stories will be released in January, and it's called Give Me Your Heart. Now, please give her your ears and welcome Joyce Carol Oates.
Thank you so much. I'm thrilled to be here in this lovely introduction. I do sort of hold my breath to see what's going to be said next. But she didn't say the secret things. The confidential secret things that I'm hoping nobody knows about, she didn't say. But I'm so happy to be here because most of the time it's just an accomplishment to get anywhere. The airplane is very late or it's the wrong airplane and then the driver doesn't show up. And so just the fact that I'm here in what looks like, maybe it's a posthumous existence, it looks like I'm in heaven or something. It's not like this at home, actually. I spend a lot of my time writing in a very futile and frustrating way in a room, obviously, in my house, which I sort of share with my cat, Cherie. And she is completely unimpressed. It doesn't matter how many awards I've won or how charming I am and how I might feed her some special treats. It's just kind of indifferent. So the applause was very thrilling, and though a bit startling and unexpected, I must say. I'm really happy to be here, and it's beautiful weather up here in Boston. And so I'm going to be reading for maybe about 15 minutes, and we're going to have a very exciting interview or conversation, I should say. And then we'll take questions from the audience, which is often the most exciting because unpredictable. Sometimes the questions are a little strange, but maybe not in Boston. You know, maybe it's other places that you have lunatics asking questions. Like I was in California not long ago. I'm going to read a story from Sourland, which is this new book of stories. It has a kind of subterranean theme of loss, grief, and then trying to forget or trying to move on. The original title was Tales of Loss, Grief, and Forgetting, but I see that's not on the book. I think the publisher thought it was too long or too complicated or too many syllables or depressing or something. And Sourland is actually the name of a place, what's a fictitious place in the book, Sourland Preserve in Minnesota. It's huge, a huge place where you can go hiking and you can get lost and so forth. And because of the title Sourland, the first cover design I saw was Sour Ball Candies. I don't know why I'm telling you this. It just seemed so completely depressing. I looked at it for a while. I was trying not to get it. You know, I think, so I sent an email and I said, you know, it's a serious book. Have you not read the book? You know, you're not supposed to ask people if they actually read a book because it's very embarrassing. So now there's a beautiful cover here, which is quite appropriate to the stories. The subterranean themes of loss and grief and forgetting and trying to move on. A woman has lost her husband. She's been married quite a while, and the death of her husband has come very unexpectedly. So there are a few stories in the volume that come back to that. And then at the end of the story, it starts in the beginning of the book, she's in a house. She's in a house. And by the end of the book, she's in this Sourland Preserve, and she's sort of gone. She's left the house, and she's taking a chance. I meant the book to have a very positive ending. I noticed that the reviewers spoke of the grotesque and the horror and the horrible things that happened, but I actually thought it was kind of a positive ending myself. I guess my threshold's a little low, my expectations. I thought it was a kind of romantic story. Well, if you read it, maybe you'll think it's, I hope you'll think it's romantic too. Granted, the man in the story, in the last story, is not Hollywood handsome exactly, but we like men for other reasons than just their appearances. But the first story I'm reading is the first story in the book, and it starts off on a different note, and the woman doesn't really leave the house. She's sort of stricken and trapped for a while inside the house. Pumpkinhead. In late March, there'd been a sleet storm through north central New Jersey. Her husband had died several days before. There was no connection, she knew. Except since that time, she'd begun to notice at twilight a curious glisten to the air. Often she found herself in the doorway of the house or outside, not remembering how she'd gotten there. For long minutes, she stared, seeing how, as colors faded, the glassy light emerged from both the sky and from the scotch pines surrounding the house. It did not seem to her a natural light, and in weak moments she thought, this is the crossing over time. She stared, not certain what she might be seeing. She felt aroused and vigilant. She felt apprehension. She wondered if the strange glisten through the air had always been there, but in her previous protected life, she hadn't noticed it. This October evening, before the sun had entirely set, headlights turned into the driveway some distance away at the road. She was startled into wakefulness, at first not sure where she was. Then she realized Anton Krupke was dropping by to see her at about this time. Dropping by, he'd said, or maybe she'd said, why don't you drop by? She couldn't see his face distinctly. He did appear to be driving a pickup truck. Out of the driver's seat in the high cab of the truck, he climbed down and lurched toward her on the shadowy path, a tall male scarecrow figure with a misshapen Halloween pumpkin for a head. What a shock. Hadley backed away, not knowing what she was seeing. The grinning pumpkin head on a man's shoulders, its leering cut-out eyes not lighted from within, but dark and glassy, and a voice issuing through the grinning slash mouth in heavily accented English. Ma'am, is correct address? You are lady of the house? She laughed nervously. She supposed she was meant to laugh. With grating mock gravity, the voice persevered. You are resident here, ma'am? I am welcome here, yes? It was a joke, one of Anton Krupke's awkward jokes. He'd succeeded in frightening Hadley, though probably that hadn't been his intention. Probably just meant to make her laugh. It was embarrassing that she'd been genuinely frightened, for she'd known perfectly well that he was coming, of course. And who else but Anton Krupke would show up like this with a Halloween pumpkin for her head? She hardly knew the man. She felt a stab of dismay that she'd invited him to drop by. Impulsively, she'd invited him, and of course, he'd said yes. At the co-op, Anton was the most eager and courteous of workers. He was the one to joke with customers and to laugh at his own jokes. He was boyish, vulnerable, and touching. His awkward speech was itself a kind of laughter, not fully intelligible, yet contagious. For all his clumsiness, you could tell he was an exceptionally intelligent man. Hadley could see he'd gone to painstaking trouble carving a Halloween pumpkin head. It was large, bulbous, weirdly veined and striated, twice the size of a normal man's head, with triangular eyes, triangular nose, and grinning mouth. Somehow, he'd managed to force the thing over his head. Hadley couldn't see how. How ingenious, Anton. Did you carve it yourself? This was a sort of inane question you asked Anton Krupke, for you had to say something to alleviate the strain of the man's aggressive, doggy eagerness to please, to impress, to make you laugh. Hadley recalled the previous time Anton had dropped by her house to see her, which had been the first time the previous week. The forced and protected conversation between them when Anton hadn't seemed to know how to depart after Hadley had served him coffee and little sandwiches. His lurching over her, his spasm of a handshake, and his clumsy wet kiss on her cheek that had seemed to sting her and to thrill her like the brush of a bat's wings. "Yes, ma'am, you think you will buy?" "That depends, Anton. How much?" "For you, ma'am, no charge." This forced joke, how long would it be kept up? Hadley wondered in exasperation. In middle school, boys like Anton Krupke were snubbed by their classmates. "Ha ha, very funny." But once you were an adult, how could you discourage such humor without being rude? Anton was considerably younger than Hadley, as much as 10 or 12 years, though he looking older than his age, as Hadley looked younger than her age. He'd been born in what was now called Bosnia, brought to the United States by a surviving grandparent. He'd gone to American schools, including MIT, yet had not become convincingly American in all those years. Trying too hard, Hadley thought, the sign of the foreign-born. In a kind of anxious triumph, sensing his hostess's exasperation yet determined not to acknowledge it, Anton swung the lurid pumpkin head down from his shoulders in his chaff-looking, big-knuckled hands. Now she could see the pumpkin wasn't whole, but only two-thirds of a shell. It had been guttered and carved and its back part cut away, the back of what would be in a human skull, the cranium. So the uncanny pumpkin head was only a kind of pumpkin mask set on Anton's shoulders and held in place by hand, yet so lifelike. As the scarecrow figure lurched up the walk in her direction, the face had appeared alive. "Is good? Is surprise? Happy Halloween, is right?" Was it Halloween? Hadley was sure it was not. October 31st wasn't for another few days. "It's for you, Hadley, to set here." Flush-faced now and smiling in the shyly aggressive manner that was a plea for her, the rich American woman, to laugh at him and with him, to laugh in a spontaneous way in which Americans laugh together, mysteriously bonded in their crude American humor. On his angular face and in his wiry, stiff hair that receded sharply from his forehead were bits of pumpkin flesh and seeds at which he wiped surreptitiously like a boy whose nose is running, wiping at his nose. Hadley thought, "If he kisses me, he will smell a pumpkin." Her husband had died and abandoned her. Now other men would drop by the house. Anton presented Hadley with a misshapen pumpkin. The damn thing must have weighed 15 pounds and almost slipped from her hands. "Anton, thank you. This is very..." Their hands brushed together. Anton was standing quite close beside her. He was several inches taller than Hadley, though his posture was slouched, his back prematurely rounded. Perhaps there was something wrong with his spine, and he breathed quickly and audibly, as if he were about to declare something, then thought better of it. At the organic food and gardening co-op where Hadley had once shopped frequently, when she prepared elaborate meals for herself and her husband, and now only shopped from time to time, tall, lanky Anton Krupke had appeared perhaps a year ago. He'd always been alert and attentive to her. The co-op manager addressed her as Mrs. Shell. Since late March, in her trance of self-absorption that was like a narcotic to her, in fact, to get through the worst of her insomnia at nights, Hadley had to take sleeping pills, which left her dazed and groggy through much of the day. She'd scarcely been aware of Anton Krupke except as a helpful and persistent presence, a worker who seemed always to be waiting on her. It was just recently that he dared to be more direct, asking if he might see her, or he might drop by her house to bring her several bags of peat moss that were too heavy for her to bring home in her car. Hedley had hesitated before saying yes. It was true, she was attracted to Anton Treffy to a degree. He reminded her of foreign-born classmates in her school in Philadelphia, pasty-faced skinny boys with round eyeglasses, tortured ways of speaking as if their tongues were malformed. Hedley had been attracted to them, but she'd never befriended them. Not even the lonely girls had she befriended. And now, in weak moments, she was grateful for anyone who was kind to her. Since her husband's premature death, she'd felt eviscerated and worthless. There is not one person to whom you matter now. This is the crossing over. She had signed the paper for her husband's cremation, and her memory distorted and blurred by tears, as if undersea, her own name had been printed on the contract beside her husband's name. Signing for him, she'd signed for herself as well. It was finished for her, all that was over, the life of the emotions, the ability to feel. Yet, with another part of her mind, Hedley remained alert and prudent. She was not an adventurous woman, still less was she reckless. She had been married to one man for more than 20 years. She was childless and had virtually no family. She had a circle of friends in whom she confided sparingly. Often it was her closest friends whom she avoided since March. Never would she have consented to a stranger dropping by her house, except she'd learned that Anton Krupke was a postdoc fellow in a prestigious molecular biology institute. He had a PhD from MIT and he'd taught at Caltech. His area of specialization was genetics. She'd seen him at a string quartet on campus once, and another time walking along the canal towpath alone. She'd liked it that Anton Treffy hadn't noticed her at that moment, that she could observe the young man without his observing her, thinking, he's a scientist. He won't see anything that isn't crucial for him to see. Now in her house, she felt a frisson of power over her awkward visitor. He could not have been more than 29. She was 39. She was certain that Anton hadn't known her husband or even that she'd had a husband who died. Her power, she thought, lay in her essential indifference to the man, to his very maleness, his sexuality clumsy as an odd-sized package he was obliged to carry to proffer to strangers like herself. He had the malnourished look of one who has been rebuffed many times yet remains determined. There are men of surpassing ugliness with whom women fall in love in the mysterious way of women, but Anton Krupke didn't possess anything like a charismatic ugliness. His maleness was of another species altogether. Thinking of this, Hedley felt a swell of elation. If he kisses me tonight, he will smell of garbage. Hedley was smiling. She saw how Anton stared at her as if her smile was for him. With boyish enthusiasm, Anton seized Hedley's hand. Hedley, there is more. Her fingers must have been icy and unresponsive. He pulled her with him out to the driveway, where in the rear of the pickup truck was a large pot of what appeared to be cream-colored chrysanthemums past their prime, and a box of produce, gnarly carrots, misshapen pears and peppers, bruised Macintosh apples, and a loaf of grain bread that Anton insisted had been baked only that morning and it already had not sold and so would be labeled day old the next morning. In this country, there is so much ignorant prejudice of day old. Everything has to be new, perfect shape. It is a mystery to me why if to 6 p.m. when the co-op closes, this bread is good to sell, but tomorrow by 8:30 a.m. when the co-op opens, it is old. In the place where we come from, my family, moral vehemence thickened Anton's accent. His breath came more audibly. Hedley would like to have asked Anton more about his background. He lived through a nightmare, she knew, ethnic cleansing, genocide. Yet she felt uneasy in his presence. Very likely it had been a mistake to have invited the eccentric young molecular biologist to drop by her house. She didn't want to mislead him. She was a widow who had caused her husband to be burnt to ashes and was unrepentant and unpunished. Since March, declining invitations from friends who had known her and her husband for years, impatient with their solicitude, their concern for her, who did not deserve such concern. I'm sorry. I don't want to go out. I don't want to leave the house. I'm very tired. I don't sleep any longer. I go to bed and can't sleep, and at 1 a.m. I will take a sleeping pill. At 4 a.m., I will take another. Forget me. I am something that is finished. Thinking now that maybe she didn't have to invite her awkward visitor into the house a second time, maybe he wouldn't notice her rudeness. He wouldn't know enough to interpret it as rudeness. He'd set the mums and the box of the produce on a white wrought iron bench near her front walk, and was now leaning heavily around the side of the sprawling stone and timber house, as if he'd been summoned for this purpose. He'd boasted to her being Mr. Fix-It. He was Mr. Fix-It of his lab at the Institute. His quick, critical eye took in the broken flagstones in the terrace, which he would repair for her on another visit. With the scrutiny of a professional mason, he stooped to examine the corroding mortar at the base of the back wall of the house. He examined the warped and lopsided garden gate, which he managed to fix with a deft motion of his hands. Now, it is good as new, eh? Laughing as if he said something unexpectedly witty. She was so grateful he had made no mention of the alarming profusion of weeds among a lush tangle of black-eyed Susans, Russian sage, and morning glory vines in her husband's garden that had not been cultivated this year, but allowed to grow wild. Thank you, Anton. Truly you are Mr. Fix-It. Hedley spoke with more warmth than she meant. It was her social manner, bright, a little blurred, insincere, and animated. There was something admirable, unless there was something daunting and aggressive about her visitor's energy that brimmed and thrummed like rising yeast. She would have supposed that after a day presumably spent at the molecular biology lab, work weeks in such labs could run beyond 100 hours during critical experiments, and several hours at the co-op, Anton would have been dazed with exhaustion. Yet there he was, tireless in his inspection of the exterior of her house, inspecting windows, locks, dragging aside broken limbs and storm debris. You'd think he was an old friend of the family. You have a bulb to replace, yes? And a ladder with steps, stepladder. I will put it in now before it is too dark. So adamant, Hadley had no choice but to give in. And no choice except to invite Anton Kruppi inside for just a while. Politely and with regret, explaining that she had a dinner engagement later that evening, but would he come inside for a drink? Hedley, yes, thank you. I would like, yes, so much. Stammering with gratitude, Anton scraped his hiking boots against the welcome mat. The soles were muddy and stuck with leaves. Though she insisted it wasn't necessary, he removed the boots with a grunt and left them on the front walk, carefully placed side by side. What large boots they were, like a horse's hooves. The sodden shoelaces trailed off, left, right, in perfect symmetry. Inside, most of the downstairs rooms were dark. Now it was late October. Night came quickly. Pleasantly excited, a little nervous, Hedley went on about switching on lights. There was a curious intimacy between her and Anton Kruppi in this matter of switching on lights. Hedley heard her voice warmly uplifted, no idea what she was saying, as her tall, lanky guest in his stocking feet came to stand at the threshold of the living room and stared into the interior of the long, beautifully furnished room with a shoulder-high stone fireplace at its farther end. Above the fireplace was a 6x8 impressionist New England landscape of gorgeous pastel colors that drew the eye to it as in a vortex. Excitedly, Anton Kruppi asked, "Was this painting by Cézanne?" "Cézanne? Hardly." Hedley laughed. The question was so naive. Except for surreal pastel colors and a high degree of abstraction in the rendering of mass tree trunks and foliage, there was little in the Wolf Kahn canvas to suggest the earlier great artist. Outside, while Anton changed the floodlight, Hedley had been thinking, "I will offer him coffee. That's enough for tonight." But now that they were out of the October chill and in the house, it was a drink, wine, she offered him. A glass of dark red wine from a bottle originally purchased by her husband. Anton thanked her profusely, calling her Hedley. A flush of pleasure rose into his odd, angular face. In his wiry hair that was the color of ditch water, a small pumpkin seed shone. She poured herself a half glass of wine. Her hand shook just slightly. She thought, if I don't offer him a second glass, if I don't ask him to stay. Gratefully, Anton drank, drifting about Hedley's living room, peering at her bookshelves in his gray wool socks. Excitedly, he talked, reminding her of a chattering bird, a large, endearingly gawky bird like an ostrich, long leg and long neck, with a beaky face. His upper body, now he'd removed his nylon parka, was bony and concave. Hedley thought he would be waxy pale beneath, a hairless chest, a little pot belly, and spindly legs. Hedley laughed. Already she'd drunk half her glass of wine. A warm sensation suffused her throat and the region of her heart. Politely, she tried to listen, to concentrate, as her eccentric guest chatted rapidly and nervously and with an air of schoolboy enthusiasm. How annoying he was. Like many shy people, once he began talking, he seemed not to know how to stop. He lacked the social sleight of hand of changing the subject. He had no idea how to engage another person in conversation. Like a runaway vehicle down a hill, he plunged on, head on and heedless. And yet there was something undeniably attractive about him. More incensed now, though he seemed to be joking too, speaking of American politics and American pop culture, quote, American fundamentalist ignorance about stem cell research, and how ignorant more than 90% of Americans believe in God and in the devil. Hedley frowned at this. 90%? Was this so? It didn't seem plausible that as many people would believe in the devil as believe in God. Yes, yes, to believe in the Christian God is to believe in his enemy, the devil, that is known. With his newfound vehemence, Anton drained his glass of wine and bluntly asked of his hostess if he might have more, helping himself. Hedley wondered if he meant to be rude or simply didn't know any better. I can't really think, she persisted, that as many Americans believe in the devil as believe in God. I'm sure that isn't so. Americans are, we are a tolerant nation. How smug this sounded. Hedley paused, not knowing what she meant to say. The wine had gone quickly to her head. With a snort of derision, Anton said, a tolerant nation, is it? Such tolerance as swallows up in what it cannot, it makes of an enemy. Enemy? What do you mean? It makes a war. First is declared the enemy, then the war. Anton laughed harshly, baring his teeth. Chunky yellow teeth they were. Seeing how Hedley stared at him, he said in a voice heavy with sarcasm, first there is the tolerance, then the preempt strike. Hedley's face flushed with the heat of indignation. This was insulting. It had to be delivered. Anton Kruppi, who lived in the United States for much of his life, knew very well the history of the Iraqi war, how Americans were misled by the Republican leadership. Of course he knew. She opened her mouth to protest bitterly, then thought better of it. Surreptitiously, she glanced at her wristwatch. Only 6:48 p.m. Her guest had been inside the house for less than a half hour, but the strain of his visit was such, it seemed much longer. Still, he was prowling about and staring. Artifacts from trips Hedley and her husband had taken over the years, Indonesian pottery, African masks, Chinese wall scrolls, a wall of brightly colored primitive paintings from Mexico, Costa Rica. Yet more, the books on Hedley's shelves seemed to intrigue Anton as if these hundreds of titles acquired years ago, mostly by Hedley's husband, who'd earned both a PhD in European history and a law degree from Columbia University, possessed an immediate, singular significance and were not rather relics of a lost and irretrievable private past. You have read all these, Hedley, yes? Hedley laughed embarrassed. No, she had not. Then someone else, all these? Hedley laughed again, uncertain. Was Anton Kruppi mocking her? She felt a slight repugnance for the man who peered at her as at her art options bookshelves with an almost hostile intensity. Yet she could not help it. So American was her nature, so female. She was anxious that he should like her and admire her. As if that could be settled, she would send him away in triumph. Remembering the foreign-born children in her schools, in middle school they seemed pitiful, objects of sympathy, charity, and condescension, if not derision. In high school, overnight it seemed they'd become A students and star athletes, a drivenness to them the complacent Americans had mistaken initially as weakness. In soiled wool socks, Anton continued to prowl about. Hedley had not invited him to explore her house. His manner was more childlike than aggressive. Hadley supposed that Anton's own living quarters and university-owned housing was minimal and cramped. Ah, this is solar room. They were in a glass-walled room at the rear of the stone house. It was furnished with white wicker furniture, but now the room was dark and in shadow, and the bright festive colors were indistinguishable. Only through the vertical glass panel shone a faint crescent moon entangled in the tops of tall pines. Anton was admiring, yet faintly sneering and taunting. Such a beautiful house. It is old, is it? And so big for one person. You are so very lucky, Hedley. You know this, yes? Lucky. Hedley smiled, confused. She tried to see this. Yes, I think so. I mean, yes. So many houses in this village, as it is called, they are so big for so few people. On each acre of land, it may be one person. The demographics would show, yes? Hedley wasn't sure what Anton was saying. A brash sort of merriment shone in his eyes, widened behind the smudged lenses of his wire-rimmed schoolboy glasses. He asked Hedley how long she lived in the house, and when she told him since 1988, when she and her husband had moved here, he continued smiling, a pained, fixed smile, but did not ask about her husband. He must know then. Someone at the co-op has told him. Bluntly, Anton said, yes, it is luck. America is the land of opportunity. All that is deserved is not always granted. But it wasn't luck. My husband worked. What we have, he'd earned. And you, Hedley? You have earned also? I don't take anything for granted, not any longer. What sort of a reply was this? A stammered rush of words. Hedley had no idea. She was uneasy. Anton peered at her closely. It was as if the molecular biologist were trying to determine the meaning of her words by staring at her. It was as if his desire for the rich American woman came to him through the eyes. Hedley saw that the pumpkin seed glistened in his wiry hair that looked as if it needed shampooing and would be coarse to the touch, except she could not risk the intimacy. She felt a reckless impulse to pluck it out. He would misunderstand. He's such a fool, he would misinterpret. But if I wanted a lover for whom I felt no love. As if Anton had heard these words, his mood changed suddenly. His smile became startled and pained, asking Hedley if there was any more repairs for him to do, and she said, no, no more. Your basement, furnace, I could check. I am trained. You smile, Hedley, but it is so. Hedley was sure she wasn't smiling. More firmly, she asked Anton and told him. She thanked him and said she had to leave soon. I'm meeting friends for dinner in town. Clearly, this was a lie. Hedley could lie only flatly. Her voice quavered. She felt his eyes fixed on her. Anton took a step closer. I could come back another day if needed. I would be happy to do this, Hedley. You know, I am your friend, yes? Yes, some other time, maybe. Hedley meant to lead her awkward guest back out into the living room and to the gallery and foyer near the front door. He followed in her wake, muttering to himself, unless he was talking to her and meant her to laugh, for it seemed that he was laughing under his breath. His mood was mercurial, as if he'd been hurt in the midst of and roused to indignation. He drained his second glass of wine, and his movements had become jerky and uncoordinated like those of a partially come-to-life scarecrow. It was then that Anton began to confide in Hedley in a lowered and agitated voice. The head of his laboratory at the Institute had cheated him. He'd taken discoveries of Anton Treffy to claim for his own. He'd published a paper in which Anton was cited merely in a list of graduate assistants. And now when Anton protested, he was exiling Anton from the lab. He refused to speak to Anton at the Institute and had banished him, and so Anton had gone to the university president, demanding to be allowed to speak to the president, but of course he'd been turned away, and came back the next morning, hoping to speak with the president, and when he was told no, demanding them to speak with the provost and a university attorney. Their offices were near together, and all of them were in conspiracy together. With the head of the Institute and the head of Anton's laboratory, he knew this. Of course, he was not such a fool to not know this. He became excited, and somebody called security, and campus police arrived and led him away protesting. They had threatened to turn him over to township police, to be arrested for trespassing and threatening body harm. He had been terrified he'd be deported by Homeland Security. He had not yet American citizenship. You are smiling, Hedley? What is the joke? Smiling? During this long breath of speech, Headley had been staring at him in astonishment. It is amusing to you, yes, that all my work, my effort, I am most hardworking in the lab. A supervisor exploits my good nature. He is always saying, Anton is the stoic among us. What this means is flattery of Americans is how you can be used, to be used. That is our purpose to the Institute. But you must not indicate you are in the know. Anton spoke like one whose grievances are so much in excess of his ability to express them, he might have been a bearer of an ancient racial burden. And now, after 3 years, when my findings are cheated from me and I am no more use, it is time to toss away into the dumpster. That is a good word. Good joke, huh? Dumpster, very good American joke. The Institute is saying my contract will not be renewed, for the federal grant is ended. And my supervisor had not ever gotten around to aiding me with my citizenship application, years it has been. Of course, I have been dilatory myself. I have been working so hard in the lab. Yesterday morning, a decision came to me by email. You must not smile, Headley. That's very selfish. That's very selfish and very cruel. The indignant man loomed over Headley. His angular face wasn't so soft now, but hardened with strain. His jaws were clenched like muscles. A sweaty, garbagey smell wafted from his heated body. Behind the schoolboy lenses, his eyes were deep-socketed and wary. Headley said nervously, maybe you should leave, Anton. I'm expecting friends. I mean, they're dropping by to take me with them to dinner in town. She didn't want her agitated visitor to sense how frightened she was. Her mistake was in turning away to lead him to the door, insulting him. His arm looped around her neck, and in an instant they were struggling off balance. He caught at her and kissed her. He kissed her and bit at her lips like a suddenly ravenous rodent. Both their wine glasses went flying to the floor. You like this, Headley. This you want. For this you ask me. He overcame her. She was fighting him, whimpering and trying to scream, trying to draw breath to scream. But he pushed her down. Horribly, she was on the floor, pushed down helpless in panic, on the floor of her own house, in terror thinking that Anton was trying to strangle her. Then it seemed that he was kissing her, or trying to. In panic, she jammed her elbows into his chest. His mouth came over hers again. His mouth was wet and ravenous, and his teeth closed over her lip. In terror, she thought he might bite off her lip. In a kind of manic elation, he was murmuring what sounded like, you like this, you want this. Grunting with effort, he straddled her. His face was flushed with emotion and fury. He brought his knee up between her legs, roughly. Their struggle had become purely physical and desperate, enacted now in near silence except for their panting breaths. Headley had no idea what she was doing except moving her head from side to side, trying to avoid the man's mouth, the sharp teeth, the smell of his breath. His mouth was like that of a great sea leech sucking at her tongue. The back of her head was being struck against a hardwood floor, oh, 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 as if he wanted to crack her skull. His fingers were poking and jabbing at her between her legs. In a paroxysm of desperation, she managed to squirm out from beneath him, like a panicked animal crawling on hands and knees. And almost in that instant, she believed she might escape Anton Krupke. Except he had only to lunge after her, seize her ankle in his strong fingers, laughing and climbing over her, straddling her again, more forcibly this time, closing his fingers around her neck. And now she knew she could not escape. She knew it was certain she would die. He was saying, you want me here. You ask for this. You have no right to laugh at me, you and your trusty husband. In the confusion of the moment, Headley had no idea what Anton was saying. Trustee? Her husband had served on an advisory board for the history department at the university, but he had no association with the Molecular Biology Institute. She could not have explained this. She hadn't the strength. She felt her assailant's fingers now poking inside her. She cried out in pain and kicked at him, squirming beneath him like a creature desperate to escape a predator. Yet she had time to think almost calmly. This can't be happening. This is wrong. She seemed to see herself with a strange stillness and detachment, as if her mind had slipped free from all that was physical and visceral. What was happening to her was at a little distance, though tasting now the wine on the man's tongue, the dark, sour, feral wine taste of a man's mouth like her own. He'd lost patience now and was jamming at her with two fingers, three fingers, forced up inside the soft flesh between her legs, which Headley knew was loathed by the man. He was furious with her and disgusted with her. His head was pure and fiery for her as she begged him, "Please don't hurt me, Anton. I want to be your friend. I will help you." It wasn't wine she was tasting, but blood. He'd bitten her upper lip. On his feet now, looming over her, his work trousers disheveled, his shirt loose and blood splattered, he managed to get to his feet, disengaging himself from her, stiff-legged as a scarecrow come to partway to life, and was gone. She lay very still. Where he'd left her, she lay with a pounding heart, bathed in sweat and the smell of him, her brain stuck blank, oblivious of her surroundings, until after several minutes, as many as 10 or 15, she realized that she was alone. It had not quite happened to her as she believed it would happen, the crossing over. She managed to get to her feet. She was dazed and sobbing. Some time was required that she could stand without swaying. Leaning against a chair in the hall, touching the walls, in the open doorway, she stood staring outside. The front walk was dimly illuminated by a crescent moon. Here was a meager light, a near to fading light. She saw that the pumpkin head had fallen from the step or been kicked. On its side, it was revealed to be part shattered. You could see that the back of the cranium was missing. Brains had been scooped out, but negligently, so the seeds remained. She stepped outside. Her clothing was torn. Her clothing was both expensive and tasteful, had been torn and was splattered with blood. She wiped at her mouth that was bleeding. She would run back in the house. She would dial 911. She would report an assault. She would summon help, for badly she required help. She knew that Anton Krupke would return. Certainly, he would return. On the front walk, she stood staring toward the road, what she could see of the road in the darkness. On a roadway, there were headlights, an unmoving vehicle. It was very dark. A winter dark had come upon them. She called out, "Hello? Hello? Who is it?" Headlights on the roadway where his vehicle was parked. Thank you.
Joyce, is that a happy ending?
Well, it's the first story in a book. You know, she's going on a journey, and this is like the first story, so it's an irresolute ending.
Thank you. You know, in your introduction, I read the line from the Booklist review that said that calls your stories cruel fairy tales. So what for you is a happy ending? What constitutes a happy ending?
I think most writers don't think in terms of happy endings. They're a work of art or any it could be a movie or even music, a play, short stories, novels. They have their own integrity, and the characters move through some experience as a sort of trajectory. And there's an inevitable ending, but I don't think that one sets out to write, quote, a happy ending or an unhappy ending. That would be very naive. I can't imagine that.
There's this sense among many of your characters in Sourland that they somehow deserve the violence that befalls them. You have healthy children who are bargaining for dying parents' lives by offering themselves up to assault, and you have widows who somehow feel they deserve punished for surviving, and you have upper middle class women who feel sexual violence is somehow, you know, inescapable or warranted. And I've read Catholic, but you call yourself an atheist now, is that right? Oh, no? Okay. Well, I'll finish my question. And this is what happens when you research things online. Well, you can correct me on that. But I wonder, this sort of prevalence of, my question is, there's this kind of prevalence of original sin. Where does that come from? And set me straight on where you stand spiritually.
Well, I just have to say that it's a little awkward to have a conversation if we have to do this, because each of us would make little speeches or something. But
so I'll yell.
No, that's okay. As I say, I don't think writers set off to have these endings that are uplifting or pessimistic. You take people through a trajectory of experience that is supposed to be in some way plausible or inevitable. And then if somebody else thinks it's pessimistic or somebody else thinks it's tragic or hilarious, that's sort of from the outside, you know. There are scenes in Shakespeare that might be grotesquely comic to some people and might be tragic to somebody else. These things are a matter of interpretation. I don't have a sense of original sin. I think it's very naive to think that way, but I'm very interested in religion and different manifestations of religion.
Okay, I'm going to bring it up.
You know, there are biological underpinnings for many of the things that we believe or think we believe, and I'm interested in that sort of evolutionary psychology, that's sort of the underpinning.
This one? How exciting.
Oh, wow.
Thank you. But
I wouldn't call myself an atheist. That seems very aggressive.
Oh, I don't mean to be aggressive.
No, it would be aggressive.
What do you call yourself anything? Do you call yourself Catholic?
Only when I'm interviewed, I'm sort of put on the spot. I don't call myself anything.
Do you believe in God?
Well, do you believe in God?
I do, but nobody's here to hear me talk about God.
Well, who's your God? I mean, is this a man?
Or she's a very wise black woman.
Oh, she's a, well, you're being funny. I mean, that's a joke.
Well, she's everybody, or he, it. I mean, but nobody wants to hear what my name's Faith, whatever, we can get into it later.
Well,
it's
just the concept of God is a very, very large concept, and most people don't know what anybody else means by it. So if you say you believe in God, you know, it's like saying, do you believe in the sky or something? I mean, it's not fruitful to discuss this.
Wow.
I mean, why would it be? Because, as I say, people have different religions. If
right.
we were in India and you asked me to believe in God, it'd be a different question from asking me in Trinity Church. I could say I believe in God. I believe in the same God everybody else believes in if I'm running for political office.
Right. I think that's when it's fruitful to discuss. People think it's fruitful to discuss.
Well, most people have a sense of religion that is honoring their parents and the community, and they don't want to violate it. And so out of respect and sympathy, they're likely to say that they believe what their parents believe. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I think that throughout history, people have rebelled against that, and some very interesting people like Emily Dickinson rebelled against it, Henry David Thoreau. I mean, many, many people rebelled against it. But most people don't rebel against it. It's not contemptible to not rebel. But these questions, if you study philosophy or you're teaching philosophy, these questions are immediately analyzed in terms of language because the actual words don't mean anything much to other people. They're mysterious words like syllables in different languages that people don't understand.
While we're on very personal, arguably tough questions, I'd love to know, there's this adage, write what you know, and you often write about violence. Have you experienced violence personally?
Well, again, writers don't write about violence. Writers write about people. I write about people, human beings. Some of them are domestic and loving. They have children. They have cats. Some of them commit violent acts. Some of them do mow the grass. I mean, writers write about people. And I don't know why women writers particularly are asked these questions. Toni Morrison was asked this a lot. What can I say? Writers hold up a mirror to the world. I was asked that question about violence when I was being interviewed in Berlin and Warsaw. You know, the soil is soaked with blood in parts of Europe, or maybe all of Europe. And then to ask me that question as if I had made up violence, you know, this American woman, it just seemed very ironic. I just sort of smiled and I said, are we in Berlin? You know, but they said, why is your writing so violent? Well, the world is violent.
Oh, but that's not the question I'm asking. But I wonder if it's something that you've experienced personally. But if you're tired of that question, let's move on to another one.
I don't only write about myself. I write about lots of people. I've written many books, and I don't only write about what's happened to me.
How do you know when a story should be a short story rather than a novel?
Well, if it's about 15 pages long and not 500, it looks like a story. I'm asked that question a lot also.
Oh, shoot.
No, that's okay.
What's your favorite color?
No, these are good questions because they are being asked often, so I guess there's a whole, you know, a thirst for them. Most writers know what they're doing actually. So if they're going to write a short story, it's a short story. I mean,
do you know it ahead of time? Before you sit down to write that.
A person would sit down and write a 500-page novel instead of a short story? Of course you know what you're doing.
I'm not an author, so this is interesting to me.
Well, you'd be an interesting author. You'd sit.
Thank you.
You'd sit down and say, well, not sure what I'm going to do today. Maybe War and Peace? Or maybe a limerick. I'll just have to see what comes out. If you're writing War and Peace, you plan it. You have a sense of where it's going. You have a lot of characters. If you're writing a limerick, you get the rhymes right. It's not a mystery. Not a mystery.
When you're not writing, who are you? What do you do?
When I'm not writing, right now?
Do you?
The faintest idea. I'm wondering. I'm not going to give the answer that.
I'm trying to picture Joyce Carol. Like, do you watch TV? Do you watch, TV? Do you go for a run? Do you bake biscotti? I mean, people think of Joyce Carol Oates as always writing and teaching.
Who are these people? Are there long lines of people who say, oh, we know Joyce Carol Oates only writes? I think probably most people don't think much about me at all, and I'm not hurt. I accept it. I do many different things. I live in Princeton, New Jersey, which is an area you may have heard of. There's a university there. There's an institute. People are all writing and reading. It's an intellectual community. We're all working. I'm not the hardest working person I know. It's not considered weird or freaky to be working. It's not considered that bizarre. And some people do look at television, but it's not anything special,
You have got to run for office.
Oh, no, I could never run for office because I'm not going to make up things. I'm going to tell the truth, so you can't possibly run for office. It's all, it's a fabric of lies and a tissue of words that people think other people want to hear. That's basically what politics is. Am I wrong?
All right. We have so little time.
Feeble applause. That was feeble applause.
All right, let's give the woman robust applause.
Wow. When I tell my cat Cherie about this, she won't believe it.
Oh. You just anticipated my next question. I have loads of questions, but I already have a feeling how you're going to answer them. So I was going to ask you what your cat's name is, but you just
Well, I've had a whole sequence of cats because I'm not a person who's only arrived in the world, a few years ago. So I've been around and there's a whole long, long sequence of cats. And Cherie is it's like a polygamous man with all these creatures. And I have Cherie. Now, I want to say, often I'm asked how I write so much. And did you ask that yet? It's like number 20. Okay. I'll tell you the answer before we get to it.
It's not on my list, believe it or not.
That's a serious question. Actually, it's serious. I write so much because my cats sit in my lap. And this cat is a long-haired sort of a Persian. You know what they're like. They're very bossy. Some of you probably know what they're like. They're very egotistical, and they just sort of lie there, and she purrs. So I say I want to get up. She won't let me get up. She puts the claws go in, and she doesn't want to get up. And then after a while, I want to get up again. The tail's switching. I can't get up, so I write much more than I would have.
And there's one of the secrets.
I would only say this away from Princeton. I don't want my friends to know any of this.
So if you want to be, I guess the takeaway today is if you want to be a writer, don't get your cats declawed.
That's right. But actually, to be serious for a minute, cats are very calming. And I find my cat, I also have a husband, but somehow the cat, the cat is more calming. The cat purrs. Of course, snoring can sound like purring, but it's not the same thing. I can't believe that I'm saying these things. I hope this isn't on YouTube. Oh, my God.
We are virtually out of time, but surely a couple of you out there can do a better job than I have.
No, you've done
wonderful. In coming up with an innovative question. So there's a mic right there. Does anybody have a question? All right. How about you? Please yell. Any advice for young writers?
Advice for young writers. I'll give a serious answer to that. Advice for young writers. Actually, I've been teaching young writers for a long time. I've been teaching them so long that they're not young any longer. And I've had a whole sequence of really, really wonderful writers. I think the best thing is to read a lot. Just read anything you like. I particularly recommend to read one writer, everything by one writer, to start when he or she was young. You read the first short stories of Ernest Hemingway. I teach writing by very young writers who then become famous, like Updike and Cheever and Carson McCullers and even Kafka. I like to teach go with my students over these stories that they wrote when they were about 25 or so, and then the students may keep on reading as the writing gets more complicated. Just read a lot, and also talk to people and let other people talk. And I said to have I have a nice assignment for my students that brings in wonderful work, where I ask them to interview one of their family members, and like a grandparent. And not to talk, but just to interview and listen. And those have been really, really wonderful. They've been very touching and very profound.
Joyce, you said of your early work, of your unpublished work, that you cheerfully threw it away. Is that right?
I've thrown quite a bit of work away. Some critics would say not enough, but I have thrown quite a bit away.
Do you ever throw anything away now?
Well, it's a hard question to answer because I don't know whether you mean it. I'm not sure what you mean. I never give up on a project. Of course I throw pages away as I'm working on it, but I've never given up on a project. And then when a whole novel is done, I have been known to not publish it. But I don't think it's thrown away exactly. It's in my archives at Syracuse University.
Yes.
Thank you for calling on me. I just have a quick question, and I wanted to know if the following is actually true or not. It's something I read in the media a long time ago about Joyce Carol Oates, and I think it was in the New York Times even, and it said Joyce Carol Oates and her husband have an agreement that he never reads anything she writes. Now, again, I don't know if that's true or not, and when I read that, I thought, I wonder why they have such an agreement. Do you, and why?
Well, that's a very interesting issue. I think I have many writer friends. I have many women friends who are writers. Do you want someone to read your work, sort of standing almost looking over your shoulder? Do you want more privacy? Do you want your own freedom to write what you want? I think it's an issue that everybody has to decide. I've been married twice, and my first husband and I were married for 47 years, and he died in 2008. And he was at Raymond Smith. He was an editor and publisher. He had work coming in constantly. He was always editing manuscripts. I felt that I didn't want to add to all his reading, and I also felt that I needed, because I'm somewhat shy. I didn't sound shy tonight, but I was sort of shy around him, and he was 8 years older than I was. I guess I always felt that I didn't want him to read my writing, because then he would find out things about me that weren't evident in our marriage. And I think that, just to be very candid about it. But now that I look back upon it, I think that's all right. I think that if you're a writer, if you're a woman or a young woman and you're writing, you may not want your family or other people to read everything you write, and you might want to think about writing under a pseudonym. That will give you immense freedom. Immediately, the sense of energy comes out. When you can write without anybody having an opinion of it, then that's fine. But I'm remarried, and my husband now really demands that he reads everything I write. And at first I thought, I wasn't used to this at all, and I felt very uneasy. And I thought, well, no, this is just, I can't do this. But he just kept asking and asking, and finally, he was a little bit coercive, I suppose. So finally, he reads everything now. So it's been like one 180-degree change, and I'm not sure. I'm sort of like this woman in the short story that I read. She kept doing things and then realizing she was making mistakes. And then she wondered, like, why did I do that? And I let this man in the house, and why am I having wine? Everything that she's done is sort of like a mistake, and yet it all added up to an experience. And she didn't exactly, not deserve what happened to her. I'm not saying that people should be raped or violated for letting people in the house. I don't mean that. But there's a way in which you do things gropingly and intuitively that may seem like mistakes, but then they turn out all right in the end.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for that question. Time for one more. Thank you.
Hi. I'm wondering, I heard an interview, or not an interview, but a review recently of your latest book, and then having heard one of, now of your stories in this collection, I'm wondering, as an artist, when you look back on your latest work and the story in particular, I know as a reader myself, I heard things and admired aspects of it, but as a piece of art, in your latest collection and in this story in particular, what you feel you've accomplished as a writer?
Well, that's almost impossible for anyone to answer. I think it's a nice question. It's very subtle. Sort of a Henry Jamesian question. I think we try. You know, Henry James says we do what we can. We give what we have, and the rest is the madness of art. Beyond a certain point, you don't really know. It's up to other people to make these judgments. What I try to do, and I think I must do. I try to present people with the complexity that we all have. That's why I was a little awkward about questions like, "Do you believe in God?" Because to me, that's a very blunt question. It doesn't have the context. You know, you have to, what kind of God, or what do you mean by the word believe? And I mean, all these things have to be sort of tempered in a way that makes them coherent. So I'd like to present people as complex human beings. I think we all are very complex. And that there's ambiguity, that a person could behave in a way that seems violent, but in the context, maybe it was an expression of confusion, an expression of a thwarted love or tenderness or possessiveness or something. Sometimes people behave in a way that seems harsh. It's because they don't know how to be tender, and the only way they can be tender is by being harsh. You know, so. That's what I would try to do, to show people in their great complexity and ambiguity.
Well, with a nod to Henry James, Joyce Carol Oates, thank you for doing what you can and giving what you have.
Thank you.